The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, please silence your cell phones. I know that's not what you thought I was going to say, but it's required. Also, please refrain from taking pictures and plan to join us upstairs after the talk for a book signing. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Ilana Blumenthal, and I'm from the National Museum of American Jewish History. I'm honored to be here this evening to introduce an American Jewish icon, the one and only Joel Grey. Actor, that deserves a clap. Actor, singer, and dancer, Joel Grey has won Oscar, Tony, and Golden Globe Awards for a wide range of stage and screen roles. The son of famed actor, comedian, and musician Mickey Katz, Grey followed suit and launched his storied career back in the 1940s. He originated the roles of Master of Ceremonies in Cabaret, George M. Cohan in George M., and the wonderful Wizard of Oz in Wicked, among a variety of other quintessential Broadway credits. In 2013, Grey was presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the National Yiddish Theater, the Volksbühne. On the big and small screens, Grey has been everything from a devil in the last episode of Dallas to a guest star on The Muppet Show. I grew up with friends who raved about a Jennifer Grey and a little film called Dirty Dancing. But as a young girl born in the wrong era and with a very old soul, I didn't know who she was. But I did, however, know who Joel Grey was and was delighted in telling the younger generation about him. I'd sing a song or two to entertain and wound up looking at their confused expressions and the delighted smiles plastered on their parents' and grandparents' faces. When I listened to his recent interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, and he talked about coming out at the age of 82, I was shocked. Not that he came out, but that he was in his 80s. In my head, he's still that young, energetic, talented, and creative man. I have no doubt we'll see these same qualities here tonight. His new memoir, Master of Ceremonies, tells the story of an extraordinary performative life and the man behind the makeup. It's a portrait of an artist coming to terms with his evolving identity. To quote the great Carol Burnett, Joel's story comes straight from his heart, right into yours. Joel will be interviewed tonight by Warren Hoffman, a playwright, dramaturg, and author of two books, including The Great White Way, Race and the Broadway Musical, and The Passing Game, Queering Jewish American Culture. He's also Associate Director of Community Programming at the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia, and most importantly, my friend. Now, I'd sing this next part, but I'll just say it for all of our sakes. Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome, Joel Grey.
Welcome to Philadelphia. It's great to have you here. It's hot. So, you've written this Hershey's.
There must be a story to this.
We'll take a field trip afterwards. So you have written this amazing, honest, open, revealing book about yourself that's just gorgeous, about your past. But most significantly about your sexuality and how you sort of came to terms with yourself as a gay man. And can you tell us a little bit about why you decided at this moment that this was you were ready to finally tell this story?
It seemed that this temperature in the country had changed enormously. And I was walking down the street one day, and I had my friends and family have known who I am forever, for a long, long, long time. And I looked around and I thought, things are different. And I need to say who I am just in case there's somebody who's confused and frightened and maybe likes my work. And I needed to stand up. I needed to be counted. As opposed to when I first had those stirrings as a small boy, all I heard was fagala, fairy, faggot, invert, jail, beatings. There was not even a possibility to think that that could be a thing that you could live with, that you could have a life. And when I was very, very young, 8, 9 years old, I lived in a hotel and in Cleveland, Ohio. And I loved babies. And I used to babysit at that age because I was so good with babies. And it was like something I always knew that I would have. And today everybody has them. It's kind of great.
Despite those things that you heard, these vicious words and what you were sort of, I guess, taught at that time, it didn't stop you from having these relationships with boys and then your age.
Girls.
And girls.
And women.
Everybody. Nobody.
Ta-da!
It's such a magnetic personality. How can you say no? But it didn't stop you from experimenting, from trying to figure out, you know, what those feelings meant.
But, well, you know, there's just a kind of human need that pulls at you that sometimes you just can't fight. Mm-hmm. And that caused a great deal of turmoil, mm-hmm, for me. Mm-hmm. And I was really, really lucky in that when I was about 28, I met a woman. And I'd been having affairs with women for years. And I had no doubt that she was the love of my life, that we would get married and we would have children, and it would be wonderful. I mean, it was so natural. It was not doing anything. It was just being with her. And we almost immediately had kids. And we had 24 wonderful years, mostly. You know, when it starts to fray the edges towards the end and things happen. The women's movement was very, very influential, I think, in terms of saying the right things about women having power in their own lives. And she had, in fact, given her life to me and our kids. And ultimately, she said that she was happier. I'm not sure she was.
Well,
that's what she said.
I would say in the book, you talk about how she was also an aspiring actress who at one point essentially gave up what could have been a career to become wife and mother. And you were excited by that she was going to play that role. Do you ever regret that you maybe have kept her from that other part of her life?
I was out of control. That wasn't a rational decision. I was depressed. I was frightened. I was really having a kind of a mini breakdown. And, you know, when you're in that kind of condition or position, it's really hard to think about anyone else.
So you had this life together, and then about, 23, 24 years towards the end of the... Uh-oh.
It's alive.
It's attacking. Towards the end of your relationship together, you decided to... in some ways, to come out to her, to tell her about, I guess, your...
The secrets of the past.
Right. And it seems, as you painted in the book, that seems to be the thing that sort of brought...
It wasn't, but yeah. It was, you mm-hmm. know. It just made it easier, mm-hmm. I think, probably for her.
Why did you decide after that amount of time to finally say something?
I loved her so much. Mm-hmm. And I was so satisfied in our life together that I thought I couldn't keep that part of myself, mm-hmm. although I had no interest in men at all at that point. Mm-hmm. I thought.
We've jumped very far into the recent history. I want us to take us back a bit to growing up. You grew up in Cleveland, and the book opens with many sort of stories and tales about both your parents. First, really, your mother Grace. Can you tell us a bit about her? She's a fascinating individual, as you write about her. What was she like?
My mother Grace was glamorous and clever, and she was an artist, and she had no interest in much but herself. She was really, that was, and I know that that came, she was one of five daughters. And my grandparents came from Russia. I said to my grandmother one day, I said, she never learned to speak English in all the years she was here. I said, when was it you came here? She says, I don't know. It was a große Schnee. It was a big snow in Europe. And also, when we were living in Cleveland, my grandfather was in the fruits and vegetables business down at the market, and she would drive his truck during the day. And I said, after I realized that she didn't speak English, I said, how'd you get a license? She says, I gave the man a couple bucks. Practical. Anyway, I don't think there was a lot of love in that house. There was a lot of chaos. And she ran to my father like a homing pigeon. And they were very much in love.
Mm-hmm. Your mother was also, it seems, responsible, at least partially responsible, for your love in the theater and the arts. How did that come about?
She took me to the theater, the Cleveland Playhouse, one day when I was about eight, and there was a production of children's theater called The Curtain Pullers, and I sat there, right about out there, and I'm looking at the stage, and I see all these kids in costumes and makeup and stories and fantastic things, and I just sat there quietly and looked, and I had a revelation. I know that now. And I said to my mother, I want to do that. And so next week she enrolled me in the class, and they seemed to think I had something, and I got a great part in the adult production that was the part of a lifetime. I got laughs, and the audience cried, and I climbed a tree, and I fell down, and I broke my back, and the audience cried. And then the heavens opened up, and I was all cured. And I was, I mean, and the audience was just like you guys. And I thought, this is what I want. And that has never stopped. Whether I was in nightclubs or movies or whatever, it was that idea of having something to do with the human condition and sharing it with an audience and being a part of that experience that the theater at its best can be.
You know, it was interesting to me that you spent a lot of your life on stage performing, and you talk about in the book how that seemed to be very similar to the ways that you felt like you had to sort of hide part of yourself, to perform another sort of version of yourself to sort of hide who you really were. Was there ever a time when you felt that
I think the only thing I was hiding was the fact that I didn't think I knew anything. I didn't know how to sing. I had no training as a dancer. And the next thing I knew, I was in my father's show called The Borscht Capades, which, contrary to public opinion, was not people skating on borscht. And I was in this show, and I sang and danced, and I didn't know what I was doing, but I guess I was so passionate about doing it that people believed it. And Eddie Cantor put me on his TV show, and the next thing I knew, I was a song and dance man who didn't know how to sing or dance. And I played in nightclubs all over the world, the London Palladium, the Shapery in Chicago, the Copacabana was where I had my audition. And I hated it. I hated all of it. It was smoky and people were drinking and weren't paying attention. It was not the experience that I had at the Playhouse as an actor. And one of the things that's important to be in a nightclub is to make things up like that. And in the theater, you never, never change the text. So that was always a struggle for me. Mm-hmm. And one day I was working in the Buffalo Town Casino in February. And there were about 12 people in the audience, three of which were at the ringside, and two of which were just about having sex. And I'm singing and just giving my all. The band is playing, and what are you going to do, right? And the number is over. There's a few people applauding. And this guy who was on this woman turned around to me. He said, "Get off the stage. Nobody wants to see you anyway." That sort of stopped me for a while. And I knew that I had to get back to the theater, but I had no idea that I would run into such a class thing from the theater, where they thought that people from nightclubs were far below the art of the theater. So I couldn't even get auditions. And I just kept... By this time, I was married with a couple of children and working and trying to, you know, to do what I needed to do. And I finally went out on tour with a show called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, which was a great part. And a part that needed a singer and a dancer and a mime and also, most importantly, an actor. And I had a success with that. And I toured all over the country, and I had by that time replaced a young man in Come Blow Your Horn, Anthony Newley in Stop the World, Anthony Newley in Roar the Grease Paint, and there was one more. And I thought, this is not what I had in mind. And my soul was kind of singed. And I said, I'm quitting. And that, about 2 days later, the telephone rang, and it was Hal Prince, who had become a good friend over those years. And he said, Jolie, he's the only person, except for my Aunt Jean, who called me Jolie. He said, what's the matter? I said, no work. Things are just awful. Oh, well, then this is a good phone call. Remember I was telling you about a show I was going to do? I Am a Camera, Christopher Isherwood, The Berlin Stories, making it into a musical. Well, we've done that. John Kander and Fred Ebb and Joe Masteroff and Ron Field. And we all think there's a swell part in it for you. Okay. So cheer up. And that was the first part that I never auditioned for. And I went to the reading where everybody heard the score for the first time. And John Kander was sitting at the piano and Fred Ebb was standing over there. And John went, crash. And Fred sang, Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. And I thought to myself, that song is going to be mine. And my life just sort of changed from then on.
It's fascinating because you began saying how you wanted to get out of nightclubs, and yet this major role is set in a nightclub. And you drew from that, and tell us about your inspiration for how you discovered the role of the MC. It's a fascinating...
Well, I never knew that all that horror of working in clubs was going to, in fact, inform exactly what I needed to know. But then it needed to go further. I saw, when I was traveling, I stopped in St. Louis, and there was a comedian that people were talking about was the new hot guy. And on a night off, I went to see him, and he was sweating, and he had pancake makeup on, and his hair was thinning, and he had the worst jokes, fag jokes and Jew jokes, and blah, blah, blah. He was horrible, and the audience loved him. And I thought to myself, how is this possible? He absolutely had them in the palm of his hand. And he was ugly. I mean, not just ugly looking, but everything about him was dark. And one day in rehearsal, I was struggling to find the character of the MC, and I thought, maybe I'll play him like that guy for this one number. Crash. Pop. Ladies and gentlemen, places please for Willkommen. And I stood there, and all of a sudden I was that guy lifting the skirts of the girls, poking them down their breasts, squeezing them, being ridiculous and outrageous and smartass and just disgusting. And I finished, and they said, it's a break. And I ran away to the back of the theater to hide behind a flat, thinking, oh, my God, now what have I done? they're going to think that's me. This is the end of my career. And I was devastated. Hand on my shoulder. Jolie? And it was Hal. He said, that's it. And so he was born.
And this became, in many ways, your signature role. I mean, you won the Tony for it. You played the role in the film version. You won the Academy Award for it. How did it change your career, in addition to all those awards? Did it become easier after that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could turn down a thing or two. Things were better.
Good.
Yeah, I went into George M. Mm-hmm. the year after that, and then the film of Cabaret came up, mm-hmm. and Bob Fosse didn't want me for the film. And I was, once again, thought, what do you have to do? And I think it was about six, nobody had any idea what it was he had in his mind. He auditioned Anthony Newley, I think, and talked about Ruth Gordon. The year of living dangerously. And, but the producers kind of always wanted me. And he came in 6 weeks before shooting began, and he said, well, gentlemen, this is the moment of truth. It's either Joel Grey or me. And Marty Baum, who was the producer, said, then it's Joel Grey. The director is king. That has never, ever happened before. And it made for a lot of tension during the six-week shoot. And I think that the fact that there was that stuff between us where I was watching him like a hawk, that he shouldn't fuck up my movie, my play, my life, my world, I felt very ornery about Cabaret. And I didn't know that he was going to be tough enough, because he had used to do a lot of very, you know, clever kind of choreography that I never thought was the right dark atmosphere. And he wouldn't give me an inch, and I didn't give him a half an inch. And the result was the movie. And I was very proud and loved his work. Was grateful to be a part of it. And that's how the blues was born.
I wonder if you could tell us about another work that seems to be very close to your heart, which is actually The Normal Heart, a play by Larry Kramer about the AIDS crisis in the gay community in the 1980s. You saw the play, were very moved by it. And then you actually got to go into it and then actually have more history with it. What was it about this play that resonated with you so much?
Well, it was everything I wasn't. It was outrageous and rude and in your face. And nothing was held back. And I wanted to be a nice boy. And, you know, I always tried to be a nice boy. There was always that something in me that wanted to do that. And I thought saying these fiery words and speaking about an AIDS crisis that was on the last pages of the New York Times, nobody was believing in it. Nobody believed it was happening. And men were dying in the hundreds. So I felt like I was giving something and also finding out something about myself. And there were some audiences that were very uncomfortable. People who saw me in George M. came to that, and I would very often hear a little shuffling and people leaving. That's not my Joel Gray. And I didn't give a shit. I knew that what we were doing was right. And just before we started rehearsal, there was a lot of talk about getting it, getting AIDS from kissing. And there's a big scene that my character, Ned, falls in love with this man and kisses him flat, square on the mouth, passionately. And a friend of mine said, you know, they're not sure about whether that's safe. You don't know this actor. I think you should call an expert and see whether or not they think it's safe to do. So somebody put me in touch with the guy who was doing all the work in UCLA and was also taking care of Rock Hudson. And I got him on the phone and I said, there's the scene, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-da. And his answer to me, his question to me was, well, do you have to kiss him? I said, yeah, I think it's absolutely important to the story and the piece. And there was this silence, and then I heard his voice say, then I wouldn't do the play. But as we all know, I did the play. I loved the play. I ended up directing it in Los Angeles and directing a benefit in New York, and then with George Wolfe, made this wonderful piece on Broadway, and for the first time, got Larry Kramer, the Tony. So it was totally satisfying.
That's wonderful.
The guy was a good kisser, too.
We have to end shortly before we go into our sort of a Q&A session, but I want to take us back in time for one last sort of moment, because I want you to talk a little bit about your dad, Mickey Katz.
Oy geb mir heim mit der Weibelchen, wo die Sheeps in the Chigalach leifen. Oy geb mir a Haus mit gesunde Cowboys und a couple hundred cattle zu verkaufen. Now everybody sings. Haim, haim off and range. That was the beginning of my wonderful father, Mickey Katz's success. And he made about 30 records after that. Herring Boats Are Coming with Bagels and Lox. Tickle, tickle. You tickle me, I tickle you. You tickle me, I tickle you. And my favorite, and it's the one that I always want to sing, because I know that whenever I sing it, Walt Disney turns over in his grave. Matches and knishes, it's so delicious. Listen, you all hairs up too. But if you're flicking, there's nothing like chicken for the baby, the Bobby, and you.
There you are.
Was it hard to, you know, you were part of the Borschtcapades where, you know, he's doing some of these numbers. Was it hard to leave that? It sounds like it was a lot of fun.
It was, but it was kind of a blast and nothing that really sat with me, because it was contradicting all of the things that I dreamt about. When I did the show, my father wrote an opening song for me. And that's the last thing I'm going to sing. I'm 16. Are you picturing it? When I was 8 days old, they named me Yossel. Oh, what a simcha, such a celebration. All my mishpocha drank a toast, l'chaim. While I was suffering a minor operation. And later on, I went to kindergarten. I said, "Teacher, Yossel is my name." She said the name of Yossel. It sounds like a schlamossel. From Yossel, my name became Joel Gray. And that was it.
So I'm sure many people in the audience have some questions for you. So there'll be people, if you want to raise your hand, there are people coming around with microphones. Wait until you have a microphone to say your question, and then you'll get an answer. Maybe.
Was there ever a part that you wanted to play that you never got to audition for, or that you just never got to be?
Yes, I always wanted to... I thought I wanted to play Richard III for a lot of years. And just the time just never worked out. And also, I would have loved to have played The Merchant of Venice. I think that would have been good, too.
I was wondering, did Alan Cumming ever talk to you before, during, or after the revival Cabaret?
No. But I did see him, and I thought he was wonderful. Just, it's a, you know, these parts, these classic parts, they get played by a lot of actors, and everybody has to bring their own thing to it. And he brought something very, very different, as did the whole, that whole production was so different. The only thing that ever bothered me about that is that, for some reason, people forgot totally how daring and scary and shocking the 1966 Cabaret was. And they thought this was so much more daring and shocking. They're wrong.
Wait, Joel.
Hi.
Hi. I don't have a question, but I
do... Take that microphone away from him.
I do want to recall to you that I saw your dad many times in the Catskills, and I saw you in Browns once, and I have very fond recollections of both you and your dad.
Well, that was me at Browns, but my father never played the Catskills. That's a misunderstanding about him, because he was strictly West Coast. And he did not come out of the Catskills. I came out of the Catskills.
Great.
Just because his name was Katz.
Oh. My name is also Joel Katz. And I want to tell you how much pleasure your father's records on 45 RPM gave me when I was growing up. Particularly, and maybe you'll sing a line for us, Dovid Crockett. King of Delancey Street.
Ich will gehen, wo die Katschke geht, und I wanna dreh, wie a Katschke dreht, weil Gussbrecher wuss gestoppte Hals, a Meichelin Ball und an a Gallen Schmalz.
We're back.
Oh, okay. Joe, you are so wonderful and clearly beyond talented. Question, which is more difficult, writing a meaningful personal memoir or performing on Broadway 8 times a week?
See? Is it more difficult performing on Broadway 8 times a week or writing a personal memoir like this?
Equally. Yeah. Different stresses. Different muscles. Different heartstrings.
When you're talking about daring and shocking that Cabaret was back when, What is your feeling about some of the daring, shocking shows that are considered daring and shocking today, maybe like Book of Mormon or things of that sort?
Same thing. I mean, they're appropriate for their time.
You've performed with some great legends of the theater and in movies and television and so forth. So who was the most memorable person you ever co-starred with?
Alec Guinness. I mean, I just never thought I'd be in a movie with Alec Guinness. And then I was in a movie with Laurence Olivier. You know, it was nuts.
Joel, could you talk about your photography? Which is very different from what you've been talking about all evening. One engages people in one way and another seems much more insular, at least while you're doing it.
I think that they come from the same place of dreaming, of imagining, of what am I looking at? Making sense of that. Or what is this character really feeling? And making sense of that. So I think it's always about the challenge. I have a new book that I've been working on for a couple of years that sort of has taken a back seat because of the memoir. But it's a photographs of the interiors of flowers. Sexy. The intimate lives of flowers.
Hi, welcome to Philadelphia, welcome back. I was just wondering, was there a fear of not coming out earlier that you would be rejected or not considered for some roles that you would have liked to have gotten if you had come out?
Yeah, of course. The change in perception about gay people has changed so much in the past 10 years. And nobody came out before then. You know? Neil Patrick Harris was one of the first. And not too many people, actually. And there are a lot of gay men and women in Hollywood that are still, you know, not out. And I think it must be very difficult because I think that what they're afraid of, because they've been afraid for so long, might not be exactly what they think today. But I think they were probably in such a thorough condition of fear and loathing that they can't. It's hard to risk.
But you've shown you've made it to the other side, and here you are.
I'm happy.
There's a question right here.
You mentioned you didn't know how to sing and dance, but you were singing and dancing. And I'm curious, apparently you never had any formal training, but did you have mentors that helped you with that, or you just observe what other people were doing?
Oh, no. I was in class day in, day out for hours with singing teachers and hours with tap dancing teachers and hours with ballet teachers and hours and hours and hours. I had to learn how to do it. There were different teachers.
Mr. Gray, I was just wondering, do you have any plans for the future of returning to Broadway? We're waiting.
If I did, I have no interest in doing anything long term. I think I did 8 or 9 big Broadway musicals, and those were for 1, 2, 3, and I think you did enough of that. But if there was an interesting part with something that really fascinated me, and it was for a short enough time with actors I love and a director I love, so we're dead already, I would say yes.
You're so talented, and it's such a pleasure to hear you speak tonight. I wonder if you can tell us about your daughter, Jennifer, and how does she feel about them remaking her famous movie?
She is an amazing person. She has a 14-year-old daughter, Stella, who is very much like her, challenging. And so she's getting a taste. And you know, they always say that, I hope your kids do to you. But she's wonderful, and Jen is a terrific mother. She's married to Clark Gregg, who is the star of, what's it called? The TV, it's a Marvel Comics show, and he's the lead. He's Coulson, for God's sakes, he's a hero. And Jen is on a series on Amazon called Red Oaks. And she's really wonderful on it. And you can see it. It's streaming now. And they're going to do a second season. So she gets to come to New York. And
about 20-odd years ago, you were here in Philadelphia with Cabaret. You put on a fabulous show. And at the end of that show, we found out that you never opened your mouth. You had, what'd you call it, some jitis or whatever? And it was a guy in back of the stage. We jumped up and we hollered.
You are absolutely right, and I was going to tell that first tonight because I was in Hartford, and I had a terrible cold, and I lost my voice, and the next stop was Philadelphia, which was the stop before the opening in New York. So it was really important. And I saw this brilliant laryngologist, Bob Sadaloff, and he said, you have burst a blood vessel in your vocal cord, and I don't think you can speak for a few weeks. So I thought, oh, my God, sold out, 3 weeks. And I remembered reading in Time magazine that there was an opera singer who was supposed to perform, and he lost his voice. And he had another tenor sitting in the box singing while he mouthed the words. And the audience bought it totally. My understudy sang for me, and I couldn't speak a word. I couldn't talk all day. It was a nightmare. And we never know. I went in to see him every week. He said, I don't think so. Finally, by the third week, I went in. He said, I think you can go on Sunday, which was the last performance. And we told the audience, and they were always kind of excited with the uniqueness of it, because this guy was wonderful. And he would come down and take a bow with me. So I told it at the end.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.